said angrily that the legislature would prevent the school from losing its accreditation. Phaedrus asked how. The student said they would post police to prevent it. Phaedrus pondered this for a while, then realized the enormity of the student's misconception of what accreditation was all about. That night, for the next day's lecture, he wrote out his defense of what he was doing. This was the Church of Reason lecture, which, in contrast to his usual sketchy lecture notes, was very long and very carefully elaborated. It begins with reference to a newspaper article about a country church building with an electric beer sign hanging right over the front entrance. The building had been sold and was being used as a bar. One can guess that some classroom laughter started at this point. The college was well known for drunken partying, and the image vaguely fit. The article said a number of people had complained to the church officials about it. It had been a Catholic church, and the priest who had been delegated to respond to the criticism had sounded quite irritated about the whole thing. To him, it had revealed an incredible ignorance of what a church really was. Did they think that bricks and boards and glass constituted a church? Or the shape of the roof? Here, posing as piety, was an example of the very materialism the church opposed. The building in question was not holy ground. It had been desanctified. That was the end of it. The beer sign resided over a bar, not a church, and those who couldn't tell the difference were simply revealing something about themselves. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsick, continued. Cassette 4, Side 2. The beer sign resided over a bar, not a church, and those who couldn't tell the difference were simply revealing something about themselves. Phaedrus said the same confusion existed about the university, and that was why loss of accreditation was hard to understand. The real university is not a material object. It is not a group of buildings that can be defended by police. He explained that when a college lost its accreditation, nobody came and shut down the school. There were no legal penalties, no fines, no jail sentences. Classes did not stop. Everything went on just as before. Students got the same education they would if the school didn't lose its accreditation. All that would happen, Phaedrus said, would simply be an official recognition of a condition that already existed. It would be similar to excommunication. What would happen is that the real university, which no legislature can dictate to, and which can never be identified by any location of bricks or boards or glass, would simply declare that this place was no longer holy ground. The real university would vanish from it, and all that would be left was the bricks and the books and the material manifestation. It must have been a strange concept to all of the students, and I can imagine him waiting for a long time for it to sink in. And perhaps then waiting for the question, what do you think the real university is? His notes, in response to this question, state the following. The real university, he said, has no specific location. It owns no property, it pays no salaries, and receives no material dues. The real university is a state of mind. It is that great heritage of rational thought that has been brought down to us through the centuries and which does not exist at any specific location. It's a state of mind which is regenerated throughout the centuries by a body of people who traditionally carry the title of professor, but even that title is not part of the real university. The real university is nothing less than the continuing body of reason itself. In addition to this state of mind, reason, there's a legal entity which is unfortunately called by the same name, but which is quite another thing. This is a non-profit corporation, a branch of the state with a specific address. It owns property, is capable of paying salaries, of receiving money, and of responding to legislative pressures in the process. But this second university, the legal corporation, cannot teach, does not generate new knowledge or evaluate ideas. It is not the real university at all. It is just a church building, the setting, the location at which conditions have been made favorable for the real church to exist. Confusion continually occurs in people who fail to see this difference, he said, and think that control of the church buildings implies control of the church. They see professors as employees of the second university, who should abandon reason when told to and take orders with no backtalk, the same way employees do in other corporations. They see the second university, but fail to see the first. I remember reading this for the first time and remarking about the analytic craftsmanship displayed. He avoided splitting the university into fields or departments and dealing with the results of that analysis. He also avoided the traditional split into students, faculty, and administration. When you split it either of those ways, you get a lot of dull stuff that doesn't really tell you much you can't get out of the official school bulletin. But Phaedrus split it between the church and the location. And once this cleavage is made, the same rather dull and imponderable institution seen in the bulletin suddenly is seen with a degree of clarity that wasn't previously available. On the basis of this cleavage, he provided explanations for a number of puzzling but normal aspects of university life. After these explanations, he returned to the analogy of the religious church. The citizens who build such a church and pay for it probably have in mind that they're doing this for the community. A good sermon can put the parishioners in a right frame of mind for the coming week. Sunday school will help the children grow upright. The minister who delivers the sermon and directs the Sunday school understands these goals and normally goes along with them. But he also knows that his primary goals are not to serve the community. His primary goal is always to serve God. Normally, there's no conflict. But occasionally one creeps in when trustees oppose the minister's sermons and threaten reduction of funds. That happens. A true minister in such situations must act as though he'd never heard the threats. His primary goal isn't to serve the members of the community, but always God. The primary goal of the Church of Reason, Phaedrus said, is always Socrates' old goal of truth in its ever-changing forms, as it's revealed by the process of rationality. Everything else is subordinate to that. Normally this goal is in no conflict with the location goal of improving the citizenry, but on occasion some conflict arises, as in the case of Socrates himself. It arises when trustees and legislators who've contributed large amounts of time and money to the location take points of view in opposition to the professor's lectures or public statements. They can then lean on the administration by threatening to cut off funds if the professors don't say what they want to hear. That happens too. True churchmen in such situations must act as though they had never heard these threats. Their primary goal never is to serve the community ahead of everything else. Their primary goal is to serve, through reason, the goal of truth. That was what he meant by the Church of Reason. There was no question but that it was a concept that was deeply felt by him. He was regarded as something of a troublemaker, but was never censored for it in any proportion to the amount of trouble he made. What saved him from the wrath of everyone around him was partly an unwillingness to give any support to the enemies of the college, but also partly a begrudging understanding that all of his troublemaking was ultimately motivated by a mandate they were never free from themselves. The mandate to speak the rational truth. The lecture notes explain almost all of why he acted the way he did, but leave one thing unexplained, his fanatic intensity. One can believe in the truth and in the process of reason to discover it, and in resistance to state legislatures, but why burn oneself out day after day over it? The psychological explanations that have been made to me seem inadequate. Stage fright can't sustain that kind of effort month after month. Neither does another explanation sound right, that he was trying to redeem himself for his earlier failure. There is no evidence anywhere that he ever thought of his expulsion from the university as a failure, just an enigma. The explanation I've come to arises from the discrepancy between his lack of faith in scientific reason in the laboratory and his fanatic faith expressed in the Church of Reason lecture. I was thinking about the discrepancy one day, and it suddenly came to me that it wasn't a discrepancy at all. His lack of faith in reason was why he was so fanatically dedicated to it. You are never dedicated to something you have complete confidence in. No one is fanatically shouting that the sun is going to rise tomorrow. They know it's going to rise tomorrow. When people are fanatically dedicated to political or religious faiths or any other kind of dogmas or goals, it's because these dogmas or goals are in doubt. The militancy of the Jesuits, he somewhat resembled, is a case in point. Historically, their zeal stems not from the strength of the Catholic Church, but from its weakness in the face of the Reformation. It was Phaedrus's lack of faith in reason that made him such a fanatic teacher. That makes more sense. And it makes a lot of sense out of the things that followed. That's probably why he felt such a deep kinship with so many failing students in the back rows of his classrooms. The contemptuous looks on their faces reflected the same feelings he had toward the whole rational intellectual process. The only difference was that they were contemptuous because they didn't understand it. He was contemptuous because he did. Because they didn't understand it, they had no solution but to fail, and for the rest of their lives remember the experience with bitterness. He, on the other hand, felt fanatically obliged to do something about it. That was why his Church of Reason lecture was so carefully prepared. He was telling them, you have to have faith in reason because there isn't anything else. But it was a faith he didn't have himself. It must always be remembered that this was the 1950s, not the 1970s. There were rumblings from the beatniks and early hippies at this time about the system and the square intellectualism that supported it. But hardly anyone guessed how deeply the whole edifice would be brought into doubt. So here was Phaedrus, fanatically defending an institution, the Church of Reason, that no one certainly in Bozeman, Montana, had any cause to doubt. A pre-Reformation Loyola. A militant reassuring everyone the sun would rise tomorrow when no one was worried. They just wondered about him. But now, with the most tumultuous decade of the century between him and ourselves, a decade in which reason has been assailed and assaulted beyond the wildest beliefs of the 50s, I think that in this Chautauqua, based on his discoveries, we can understand a little better what he was talking about. A solution for it all. If only that were true. So much of it's lost, there's no way of knowing. Maybe that's why I feel like an archaeologist, and have such attention about it. I have only these fragments of memory and pieces of things people tell me, and I keep wondering as we get closer if some tombs are better left shut. Chris, sitting behind me, suddenly comes to mind, and I wonder how much he knows, how much he remembers. We reach an intersection where the road from the park joins the main east-west highway, stop, and turn onto it. From here, we go over a low pass and into Bozeman itself. The road goes up now, heading west, and suddenly I'm looking forward to what's ahead. Chapter 14. We ride down out of the pass onto a small green plain. To the immediate south, we can see the pine-forested mountains that still have last winter's snow on the peaks. In all other directions appear lower mountains, more in the distance, but just as clear and sharp. This picture-postcard scenery vaguely fits memory, but not definitely. This interstate freeway we are on must not have existed then. The statement, to travel is better than to arrive, comes back to mind again, and stays. We have been traveling, and now we will arrive. For me, a period of depression comes on when I reach a temporary goal like this, and have to reorient myself toward another one. In a day or two, John and Sylvia must go back, and Chris and I must decide what we want to do next. Everything has to be reorganized. The main street of the town seems vaguely familiar, but there's a feeling of being a tourist now, and I see the shop signs are for me the tourist and not for people who live here. This isn't really a small town. People are moving too fast and too independently of one another. It's one of these population 50 to 30,000 towns that isn't exactly a town, not exactly a city, not exactly anything, really. We eat lunch in a glass and chrome restaurant that brings no recall at all. It looks as though it's been built since he lived here, and shows the same lack of self-identity seen on the main street. I go to a phone book and look for Robert DeWeese's number, but don't find it. I dial the operator, but she's never heard of the party, and can't tell me the number. I don't believe it. Were they just in his imagination? Her statement produces a panicky feeling that lasts for a moment, but then I remember their answer to my letter, telling them we were coming, and calm down. Imaginary people don't use the mails. John suggests I try to call the art department or some friends. I smoke for a while and drink coffee, and when I'm relaxed again, I do this and learn how to get there. It's not the technology that's scary. It's what it does to the relations between people, like callers and operators, that's scary. From the town to the mountains across the valley floor must be less than 10 miles, and we cross that distance now on dirt roads through rich green high alfalfa, ready for cutting, so thick it looks difficult to walk through. The fields sweep outward and slightly upward to the base of the mountains, where a much darker green of the pines rises suddenly up. That will be where the Deweeses live, where the light green and the dark green meet. The wind is full of the light green, new-mown hay smells and livestock smells. At one point we pass through a cold bank of air where the smell changes to pine, but then are back in the warmth again. Sunlight and meadows and the close-looming mountain. Just as we get to the pines, the gravel in the road becomes very deep. We slow down to first gear and 10 miles an hour, and I keep both feet off the pegs to kick the cycle upright again if it should mush into the gravel and start to go down. We round a corner and suddenly enter the pines in a very steep V canyon in the mountain, and there, right beside the road, is a large gray house with an enormous abstract iron sculpture attached to one side, and beneath it, sitting in a chair tipped back against the house, surrounded by company, is the living image of Deweese himself with a can of beer in his hand, which waves to us. Right out of the old photographs. I'm so busy keeping the machine up I can't take my hands off the grips, and I wave a leg back instead. The living image of Deweese himself grins as we pull up. "You found it," he says. Relaxed smile, happy eyes. "It's been a long time," I say. I feel happy too, though strange at suddenly seeing the image move and talk. We dismount and take off our riding gear, and I see that the open porch deck he and his guests are on is unfinished and unweathered. Deweese looks down from where it is only a few feet above the road on our side, but the V of the canyon slants so steeply that on the far side the ground descends 15 feet below the deck. The stream itself appears another 50 feet down and away from the house, among trees and deep grass, where a horse, partially hidden by the trees, grazes without looking up. Now we have to look high to see the sky. Surrounding us is the dark green forest we watched as we approached. "This is just beautiful," Sylvia says. The living image of Deweese smiles down at her. "Thank you," he says. "I'm glad you like it." His tone is all here and now, completely relaxed. I realize that although this is the authentic image of Deweese himself, it's also a brand new person who's been renewing himself continually, and I'm going to have to get to know him all over again. We step up onto the deck. Between the floorboards, it has spaces like a grate. I can see the ground through them. With a, "well, I'm not quite sure how to do this," tone and smile, Deweese makes introductions all around, but they're in one ear and out the other. I can never remember names. His guests are an art instructor from the school, who has horn-rimmed glasses, and his wife, who smiles self-consciously. They must be new. We talk for a while, Deweese mainly explaining to them who I am, and then, from where the deck disappears around the corner of the house, suddenly comes Jenny Deweese with a tray of beer cans. She is a painter too, and, I'm suddenly aware, a quick comprehender, and already there's a shared smile over the artistic economy of grabbing a can of beer instead of her hand, while she says, "Some neighbors just came over with a mess of trout for dinner. I'm so pleased." I try to think of something appropriate to say, but just nod. We sit down, I in the sunlight, where it's difficult to distinguish details of the other side of the deck in the shade. Deweese looks at me, seems about to comment on my appearance, which is undoubtedly much different from what he remembers, but something deflects this, and he turns to John instead and asks about the trip. John explains that it's been just great, something he and Sylvia have needed for years. Sylvia seconds this. "Just to be out in the open in all this space," she says. Lots of space in Montana, Deweese says, a little wistfully. He and John and the art instructor become involved in get-acquainted talk about differences between Montana and Minnesota. The horse grazes peacefully below us, and just beyond it, the water sparkles in the creek. The talk has shifted to Deweese's land here in the canyon, how long Deweese has lived here, and what art instruction at the college is like. John has a real gift for casual conversation like this that I've never had, so I just listen. After a while, the heat from the sun is so great, I take off my sweater and open my shirt. Also, to stop squinting, I bring out some sunglasses and put them on. That's better. But it blanks out the shade so completely I can hardly see faces at all, and leaves me feeling sort of visually detached from everything, but the sun and the sunlit slopes of the canyon. I think to myself about unpacking, but decide not to mention it. They know we're staying, but just intuitively allow first things to happen first. First we relax, then we unpack. What's the hurry? The beer and sun begin to toast my head like a marshmallow. Very nice. I don't know how much later I hear some comments about the movie star here come from John, and I realize he is talking about me and my sunglasses. I look over the tops of them into the shade and make out that Deweese and John and the art instructor are smiling at me. They must want me in the conversation, something about problems on the trip. They want to know what happens if something goes bad mechanically, John says. I relate the whole story of the time Chris and I were in the rainstorm and the engine quit, which is a good story, but somewhat pointless, I realize as I'm telling it, as an answer to his question. The final line about being out of gas brings the unexpected groan. And I even told him to look, Chris says. Both Deweese and Jenny comment on Chris's size. He becomes self-conscious and glows a little. They ask about his mother and his brother, and we both answer these questions as best we can. The heat of the sun finally becomes too much for me, and I shift my chair into the shade. The marshmallow feeling leaves in the sudden chill, and after a few minutes, I have to button up. Jenny notices and says, "As soon as the sun goes over the ridge up there, it gets really cold." The distance between the sun and the ridge is narrow. I judge that although it's only the middle of the afternoon, less than half an hour of direct sun remains. John asks about the mountains in the winter, and he and Deweese and the art instructor talk about this and about snowshoeing in the mountains. I could just sit here forever. Sylvia and Jenny and the art instructor's wife talk about the house, and soon Jenny invites them inside. My thoughts drift to the statement about Chris growing so fast, and suddenly the feeling of the tomb comes on. I've heard only indirectly of the time Chris lived here, and yet to them it seems that he's hardly been gone. We live in entirely different time structures. The conversation shifts on to what is current in art and music and theater, and I'm surprised at how well John keeps up his end of the conversation. I'm not basically interested in what's new in these areas, and he probably knows it, and for that reason never talks about it to me. Just the reverse of the motorcycle maintenance situation. I wonder if I look as glassy-eyed now as he does when I talk about rods and pistons. But what he and Deweese really have in common is Chris and me, and a funny stickiness is developing here, ever since the movie star comment. John's good-natured sarcasm toward his old drinking and cycling companion is chilling Deweese slightly, causing resultant respectful tones toward me from Deweese. These seem to increase John's sarcasm in a self-stoking way, and they both sense this, and so they kind of veer away from me onto some subject of agreement, and then come back again. But this stickiness develops, and they veer away again onto another agreeable subject. "Anyway," John says, "this character here told us we were in for a letdown when we came here, and we still haven't gotten over this letdown." I laugh. I hadn't wanted to build him up to it. Deweese smiles too. But then John turns to me and says, "Geez, you must have been really crazy. I mean, really nuts to leave this place. I don't care what the college is like." I see Deweese look at him, shocked, then angry. Deweese looks at me, and I wave it off. Some kind of impasse has developed, but I don't know how to get around it. "It's a beautiful place," I say weakly. Deweese says defensively, "If you were here for a while, you'd see another side to it." The instructor nods in agreement. The impasse now produces its silence. It's an impossible one to reconcile. What John said wasn't unkind. He's kinder than anyone. What he knows, and I know, but Deweese doesn't know, is that the person they're both referring to isn't much these days. Just another middle-class, middle-aged person getting along. Worried mainly about Chris, but beyond that, nothing special. But what Deweese and I know, and the Sutherlands don't know, is that there was someone, a person who lived here once, who was creatively on fire with a set of ideas no one had ever heard of before. But then something unexplained and wrong happened, and Deweese doesn't know how or why, and neither do I. The reason for the impasse, the bad feeling, is that Deweese thinks that person is here now, and there's no way I can tell him otherwise. For a brief moment, way up at the top of the ridge, the sun diffuses through the trees, and a halation of the light comes down to us. The halo expands, capturing everything in a sudden flash, and suddenly it catches me, too. "He saw too much," I say, still thinking about the impasse. But Deweese looks puzzled, and John doesn't register at all, and I realize the non sequitur too late. In the distance, a single bird cries plaintively. Now suddenly the sun has gone behind the mountain, and the whole canyon is in dull shadow. To myself, I think how uncalled for that was. You don't make statements like that. You leave the hospital with the understanding that you don't. Jenny appears with Sylvia and suggests we unpack. We agree, and she shows us to our rooms. I see that my bed has a heavy quilt on it against the cold of the night. Beautiful room. In 3 trips to the cycle and back, I have everything transferred. Then I go to Chris's room to see what needs to be unpacked, but he's cheerful and being grown up and doesn't need help. I look at him. "How do you like it here?" He says, "Fine, but it isn't anything like the way you told about it last night." "When?" "Just before we went to sleep, in the cabin." I don't know what he's referring to. He adds, "You said it was lonely here." "Why would I say that?" "I don't know." My question frustrates him, so I leave it. He must have been dreaming. When we come down to the living room, I can smell the aroma from the frying trout in the kitchen. At one end of the room, Deweese is bent over the fireplace, holding a match to some newspaper under the kindling. We watch him for a while. "We use this fireplace all summer long," he says. I reply, "I'm surprised it's this cold." Chris says he's cold, too. I send him back up for his sweater, and mine as well. "It's the evening wind," Deweese says. "It sweeps down the canyon from up high, where it's really cold." The fire flares suddenly, and then dies, and then flares again from an uneven draft. It must be windy, I think, and look through the huge windows that line one wall of the living room. Across the canyon in the dusk, I see the sharp movement of the trees. "Well, that's right," Dewey says. "You know how cold it is up there. You used to spend all your time up there." "It brings back memories," I say. A single fragment comes to mind now, of night winds all around a campfire, smaller than this one before us now, sheltered in the rock against the high wind because there are no trees. Next to the fire are cooking gear and backpacks to help give wind shelter, and a canteen filled with water gathered from the melting snow. The water had to be collected early because above the timberline, the snow stops melting when the sun goes down. Deweese says, "You've changed a lot." He is looking at me searchingly. His expression seems to ask whether this is a forbidden topic or not, and he gathers from looking at me that it is. He adds, "I guess we all have." I reply, "I'm not the same person at all." And this seems to put him a little more at ease. Were he aware of the literal truth of that, he'd be a lot less at ease. "A lot has happened," I say. "And some things have come up that have made it important to try to untangle them a little, in my own mind at least, and that's partly why I'm here." He looks at me, expecting something more, but the art instructor and his wife appear by the fireside, and we drop it. "The wind sounds like there'll be a storm tonight," the instructor says. "I don't think so," Luis says. Chris returns with the sweaters and asks if there are any ghosts up in the canyon. Luis looks at him with amusement. No, but there are wolves, he says. Chris thinks about this and asks, what do they do? Luis says, they make trouble for the ranchers. He frowns. They kill the young calves and lambs. Do they chase people? I've never heard of it, Luis says, and then, seeing that this disappoints Chris, adds, but they could. At dinner, the brook trout is accompanied by glasses of Bay County Chablis. We sit separately in chairs and sofas around the living room. One entire side of this room has the windows which would overlook the canyon, except that now it's dark outside, and the glass reflects the light from the fireplace. The glow of the fire is matched by an inner glow from the wine and fish, and we don't say much except murmurs of appreciation. Sylvia murmurs to John to notice the large pots and vases around the room. I was noticing those, John says. Fantastic. Those were made by Peter Volkas, Sylvia says. Is that right? He was a student of Mr. Deweese. Oh, for Christ's sake, I almost kicked one of those over. Deweese laughs. Later, John mumbles something a few times, looks up and announces, this does it. This just does the whole thing for us. Now we can go back for another 8 years on 2649 Colfax Avenue. Sylvia says mournfully, let's not talk about that. John looks at me for a moment. I suppose anybody with friends who can provide an evening like this can't be all bad. He nods gravely. I'm going to have to take back all those things I thought about you. All of them? I ask. Some, anyway. Deweese and the instructor smile, and some of the impasse goes away. After dinner, Jack and Willa Barsness arrive. More living images. Jack is recorded in the tomb fragments as a good person who writes and teaches English at the college. Their arrival is followed by that of a sculptor from northern Montana who herds sheep for his income. I gather from the way Deweese introduces him that I'm not supposed to have met him before. Deweese says he is trying to persuade the sculptor to join the faculty, and I say, I'll try to talk him out of it, and sit down next to him. But conversation is very sticky because the sculptor is extremely serious and suspicious, evidently because I'm not an artist. He acts like I'm a detective trying to get something on him, and it isn't until he discovers I do a lot of welding that I become okay. Motorcycle maintenance opens strange doors. He says he welds for some of the same reasons I do. After you pick up skill, welding gives a tremendous feeling of power and control over the metal. You can do anything. He brings out some photographs of things he has welded, and these show beautiful birds and animals with flowing metal surface textures that are not like anything else. Later I move over and talk with Jack and Willa. Jack is leaving to head an English department down in Boise, Idaho. His attitudes toward the department here seem guarded, but negative. They would be negative, of course, or he wouldn't be leaving. I seem to remember now he was a fiction writer, mainly, who taught English, rather than a systematic scholar who taught English. There was a continuing split in the department along these lines, which in part gave rise to, or at least accelerated the growth of, Phaedrus's wild set of ideas which no one else had ever heard of. And Jack was supportive of Phaedrus because, although he wasn't sure he knew what Phaedrus was talking about, he saw it was something a fiction writer could work with better than linguistic analysis. It's an old split, like the one between art and art history. One does it, and the other talks about how it's done, and the talk about how it's done never seems to match how one does it. Deweese brings over some instructions for assembly of an outdoor barbecue rotisserie, which he wants me to evaluate as a professional technical writer. He's spent a whole afternoon trying to get the thing together, and he wants to see these instructions totally damned. But as I read them, they look like ordinary instructions to me, and I'm at a loss to find anything wrong with them. I don't want to say this, of course, so I hunt hard for something to pick on. You can't really tell whether a set of instructions are all right until you check them against the device or procedure they describe, but I see a page separation that prevents reading without flipping back and forth between the text and illustration. Always a poor practice. I jump on this very hard, and Deweese encourages every jump. Chris takes the instructions to see what I mean. But while I'm jumping on this and describing some of the agonies of misinterpretation that bad cross-referencing can produce, I've a feeling that this isn't why Deweese found them so hard to understand. It's just the lack of smoothness and continuity which threw him off. He's unable to comprehend things when they appear in the ugly, chopped-up, grotesque sentence style common to engineering and technical writing. Science works with chunks and bits and pieces of things, with the continuity presumed, and Deweese works only with the continuities of things, with the chunks and bits and pieces presumed. What he really wants me to damn is the lack of artistic continuity, something an engineer couldn't care less about. It hangs up, really, on the classic romantic split, like everything else about technology. But Chris, meanwhile, takes the instructions and folds them around in a way I hadn't thought of, so that the illustration sits there right next to the text. I double-take this, then triple-take it, and feel like a movie cartoon character who has just walked beyond the edge of a cliff, but hasn't fallen yet because he hasn't realized his predicament. I nod, and there's silence, and then I realize my predicament, then a long laughter, as I pound Chris on the top of the head all the way down to the bottom of the canyon. When the laughter subsides, I say, "Well, anyway..." But the laughter starts all over again. What I wanted to say, I finally get in, is that I've a set of instructions at home which opens up great realms for the improvement of technical writing. They begin, "Assembly of Japanese bicycle require great peace of mind." This produces more laughter, but Sylvia and Jenny and the sculptor give sharp looks of recognition. "That's a good instruction," the sculptor says. Jenny nods too. "That's kind of why I saved it," I say. At first I laughed because of memories of bicycles I'd put together, and of course the unintended slur on Japanese manufacture. But there's a lot of wisdom in that statement. John looks at me apprehensively. I look at him with equal apprehension. We both laugh. He says, "The professor will now expound." "Peace of mind isn't at all superficial, really," I expound. "It's the whole thing. That which produces it is good maintenance. That which disturbs it is poor maintenance. What we call workability of the machine is just an objectification of this peace of mind. The ultimate test's always your own serenity. If you don't have this when you start and maintain it while you're working, you're likely to build your personal problems right into the machine itself." They just look at me, thinking about this. "It's an unconventional concept," I say, "but conventional reason bears it out. The material object of observation, the bicycle or rotisserie, can't be right or wrong. Molecules are molecules. They don't have any ethical codes to follow except those people give them. The test of the machine is in the satisfaction it gives you. There isn't any other test. If the machine produces tranquility, it's right. If it disturbs you, it's wrong until either the machine or your mind is changed. The test of the machine's always your own mind. There isn't any other test." Deweese asks, "What if the machine is wrong, and I feel peaceful about it?" Laughter. I reply, "That's self-contradictory. If you really don't care, you aren't going to know it's wrong. The thought'll never occur to you. The act of pronouncing it wrong is a form of caring." I add, "What's more common is that you feel unpeaceful, even if it's right, and I think that's the actual case here. In this case, if you're worried, it isn't right. That means it isn't checked out thoroughly enough. In any industrial situation, a machine that isn't checked out is a down machine and can't be used, even though it may work perfectly. Your worry about the rotisserie is the same thing. You haven't completed the ultimate requirement of achieving peace of mind because you feel these instructions were too complicated and you may not have understood them correctly." Deweese asks, "Well, how would you change them so I would get this peace of mind?" "That will require a lot more study than I've just given them now. The whole thing goes very deep. These rotisserie instructions begin and end exclusively with the machine. But the kind of approach I'm thinking about doesn't cut it off so narrowly. What's really angering about instructions of this sort is that they imply there's only one way to put this rotisserie together. Their way. And that presumption wipes out all the creativity. Actually, there are hundreds of ways to put the rotisserie together, and when they make you follow just one way without showing you the overall problem, the instructions become hard to follow in such a way as not to make mistakes. You lose feeling for the work, and not only that, it's very unlikely that they've told you the best way. But they're from the factory, John says. I'm from the factory, too, I say, and I know how instructions like this are put together. You go out on the assembly line with a tape recorder, and the foreman sends you to talk to the guy he needs least, the biggest goof-off he's got, and whatever he tells you, that's the instructions. The next guy might have told you something completely different and probably better, but he's too busy. They all look surprised. I might have known, DeWeese says. It's the format, I say. No writer can buck it. Technology presumes there's just one right way to do things, and there never is. And when you presume there's just one right way to do things, of course the instructions begin and end exclusively with the rotisserie. But if you have to choose among an infinite number of ways to put it together, then the relation of the machine to you, and the relation of the machine and you to the rest of the world, has to be considered. Because the selection from among many choices, the art of the work, is just as dependent upon your own mind and spirit as it is upon the material of the machine. That's why you need the peace of mind. Actually, this idea isn't so strange, I continue. Sometime look at a novice workman or a bad workman and compare his expression with that of a craftsman whose work you know is excellent, and you'll see the difference. The craftsman isn't ever following a single line of instruction. He's making decisions as he goes along. For that reason, he'll be absorbed and attentive to what he's doing, even though he doesn't deliberately contrive this. His motions and the machine are in a kind of harmony. He isn't following any set of written instructions because the nature of the material at hand determines his thoughts and motions, which simultaneously change the nature of the material at hand. The material and his thoughts are changing together in a progression of changes until his mind's at rest at the same time the material's right. Sounds like art, the instructor says. Well, it is art, I say. This divorce of art from technology is completely unnatural. It's just that it's gone on so long, you have to be an archaeologist to find out where the two separated. Rotisserie assembly is actually a long-lost branch of sculpture, so divorced from its roots by centuries of intellectual wrong turns that just to associate the two sounds ludicrous. They're not sure whether I'm kidding or not. You mean, DeWeese asks, that when I was putting this rotisserie together, I was actually sculpting it? Sure. He goes over this in his mind, smiling more and more. I wish I'd known that, he says. Laughter follows. Chris says he doesn't understand what I'm saying. That's all right, Chris, Jack Barsness says. We don't either. More laughter. I think I'll just stay with ordinary sculpture, the sculptor says. I think I'll just stick to painting, DeWeese says. I think I'll stick to drumming, John says. Chris asks, what are you going to stick to? My guns, boy, my guns, I tell him. That's the code of the West. They all laugh hard at this, and my speechifying seems forgiven. When you've got a Chautauqua in your head, it's extremely hard not to inflict it on innocent people. The conversation breaks up into groups, and I spend the rest of the party talking to Jack and Willa about developments in the English department. After the party is over, and the Sutherlands and Chris have gone to bed, DeWeese recalls my lecture, however. He says seriously, what you said about the rotisserie instructions was interesting. Jenny adds, also seriously, it sounds like you had been thinking about it for a long time. I've been thinking about concepts that underlie it for 20 years, I say. Beyond the chair in front of me, sparks fly up the chimney, drawn by the wind outside, now stronger than before. I add, almost to myself, you look at where you're going and where you are, and it never makes sense. But then you look back at where you've been, and a pattern seems to emerge. And if you project forward from that pattern, then sometimes you can come up with something. All that talk about technology and art is part of a pattern that seems to have emerged from my own life. It represents a transcendence from something I think a lot of others may be trying to transcend.
What's that?
Well, it isn't just art and technology. It's a kind of a non-coalescence between reason and feeling.
Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig, continued. Cassette 5, Side 1. It's a kind of a non-coalescence between reason and feeling. What's wrong with technology is that it's not connected in any real way with matters of the spirit and of the heart. And so it does blind, ugly things quite by accident, and gets hated for that. People haven't paid much attention to this before because the big concern has been with food, clothing, and shelter for everyone, and technology has provided these. But now, where these are assured, the ugliness is being noticed more and more, and people are asking if we must always suffer spiritually and aesthetically in order to satisfy material needs. Lately, it's become almost a national crisis. Anti-pollution drives, anti-technological communes and styles of life, and all that. Both Deweese and Jenny have understood all this for so long, there's no need for comment. So I add, what's emerging from the pattern of my own life is the belief that the crisis is being caused by the inadequacy of existing thought to cope with the situation. It can't be solved by rational means because the rationality itself is the source of the problem. The only ones who are solving it at a personal level by abandoning square rationality altogether and going by feelings alone. Like John and Sylvia here. And millions of others like them. And that seems like a wrong direction, too. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that the solution to the problem isn't that you abandon rationality, but that you expand the nature of rationality so that it's capable of coming up with a solution.
I guess I don't know what you mean, Jenny says.
Well, it's quite a bootstrap operation. It's analogous to the kind of hang-up Sir Isaac Newton had when he wanted to solve problems of instantaneous rates of change. It was unreasonable in his time to think of anything changing within a zero amount of time. Yet it's almost necessary mathematically to work with other zero quantities, such as points in space and time that no one thought were unreasonable at all, although there was no real difference. So what Newton did was say, in effect, we're going to presume there's such a thing as instantaneous change and see if we can find ways of determining what it is in various applications. The result of this presumption is the branch of mathematics known as the calculus, which every engineer uses today. Newton invented a new form of reason. He expanded reason to handle infinitesimal changes, and I think what is needed now is a similar expansion of reason to handle technological ugliness. The trouble is that the expansion has to be made at the roots, not at the branches. And that's what makes it hard to see. We're living in topsy-turvy times, and I think that what causes the topsy-turvy feeling is inadequacy of old forms of thought to deal with new experiences. I've heard it said that the only real learning results from hang-ups, where instead of expanding the branches of what you already know, you have to stop and drift laterally for a while, until you come across something that allows you to expand the roots of what you already know. Everyone's familiar with that. I think the same thing occurs with whole civilizations, when expansion's needed at the roots. You look back at the last 3,000 years, and with hindsight, you think you see neat patterns and chains of cause and effect that have made things the way they are. But if you go back to original sources, the literature of any particular era, you find that these causes were never apparent at the time they were supposed to be operating. During periods of root expansion, things have always looked as confused and topsy-turvy and purposeless as they do now. The whole Renaissance is supposed to have resulted from the topsy-turvy feeling caused by Columbus's discovery of a new world. It just shook people up. The topsy-turviness of that time is recorded everywhere. There was nothing in the flat earth views of the Old and New Testaments that predicted it. Yet people couldn't deny it. The only way they could assimilate it was to abandon the entire medieval outlook and enter into a new expansion of reason. Columbus has become such a schoolbook stereotype, it's almost impossible to imagine him as a living human being anymore. But if you really try to hold back your present knowledge about the consequences of his trip, and project yourself into his situation, then sometimes you can begin to see that our present moon exploration must be like a tea party compared to what he went through. Moon exploration doesn't involve real root expansions of thought. We've no reason to doubt that existing forms of thought are adequate to handle it. It's really just a branch extension of what Columbus did. A really new exploration, one that would look to us today the way the world looked to Columbus, would have to be in an entirely new direction. Like what? Like into realms beyond reason. I think present-day reason is an analog of the flat earth of the medieval period. If you go too far beyond it, you're presumed to fall off into insanity. And people are very much afraid of that. I think this fear of insanity is comparable to the fear people once had of falling off the edge of the world, or the fear of heretics. There's a very close analog there. But what's happening is that each year, our old flat earth of conventional reason becomes less and less adequate to handle the experiences we have, and this is creating widespread feelings of topsy-turviness. As a result, we're getting more and more people in irrational areas of thought, occultism, mysticism, drug changes, and the like, because they feel the inadequacy of classical reason to handle what they know are real experiences. I'm not sure what you mean by classical reason. Analytic reason, dialectic reason. Reason which, at the university, is sometimes considered to be the whole of understanding. You've never had to understand it, really. It's always been completely bankrupt with regard to abstract art. Non-representative art is one of the root experiences I'm talking about. Some people still condemn it because it doesn't make sense. But what's really wrong is not the art, but the sense, the classical reason, which can't grasp it. People keep looking for branch extensions of reason that will cover art's more recent occurrences, but the answers aren't in the branches, they're at the roots. A rush of wind comes furiously now, down from the mountaintop. The ancient Greeks, I say, who were the inventors of classical reason, knew better than to use it exclusively to foretell the future. They listened to the wind and predicted the future from that. That sounds insane now. But why should the inventors of reason sound insane? Deweese squints. How could they tell the future from the wind? I don't know. Maybe the same way a painter can tell the future of his painting by staring at the canvas. Our whole system of knowledge stems from their results. We've yet to understand the methods that produce these results. I think for a while, then say, when I was last here, did I talk much about the Church of Reason? Yes, you talked a lot about that. Did I ever talk about an individual named Phaedrus?
No.
Who was he? Jenny asks. He was an ancient Greek, a rhetorician, a composition major of his time. He was one of those present when reason was being invented.
You never talked about that, I don't think.
That must have come later. The rhetoricians of ancient Greece were the first teachers in the history of the Western world. Plato vilified them in all his works to grind an axe of his own. And since what we know about them is almost entirely from Plato, they're unique in that they've stood condemned throughout history without ever having their side of the story told. The Church of Reason that I talked about was founded on their graves. It's supported today by their graves. And when you dig deep into its foundations, you come across ghosts. I look at my watch. It's after 2. It's a long story, I say.
You should write all this down, Jenny says.
I nod in agreement. I'm thinking about a series of lecture essays, a sort of Chautauqua. I've been trying to work them out in my mind as we rode out here, which is probably why I sound so primed on all this stuff. It's all so huge and difficult, like trying to travel through these mountains on foot. The trouble is that essays always have to sound like God talking for eternity, and that isn't the way it ever is. People should see that it's never anything other than just one person talking from one place in time and space and circumstance. It's never been anything else, ever. But you can't get that across in an essay.
You should do it anyway, Jenny says, without trying to get it perfect.
I suppose, I say. Deweese asks, does this tie in with what you were doing on quality? It's the direct result of it, I say.
I remember something and look at Deweese. Didn't you advise me to drop it?
I said no one had ever succeeded in doing what you were trying to do.
Do you think it's possible?
I don't know. Who knows?
His expression is really concerned.
A lot of people are listening better these days, particularly the kids. They're really listening, and not just at you, to you. To you. It makes all the difference.
The wind coming down from the snowfields up above sounds for a long time throughout the house. It grows loud and high, as if in hope of sweeping the whole house, all of us, away into nothing, leaving the canyon as it once was. But the house stands, and the wind dies away again, defeated. Then it comes back, fainting a light blow from the far side, then suddenly a heavy gust from our side.
I keep listening to the wind, I say. I add, I think when the Sutherlands have left, Chris and I should do some climbing up to where that wind starts. I think it's time he got a better look at that land.
You can start from right here, Dewey says, and head back up the canyon. There's no road for 75 miles.
Then this is where we'll start, I say.
Upstairs, I'm glad to see the bed's heavy quilt again. It's become quite cold now, and it'll be needed. I undress quickly and get way down deep under the quilt, where it is warm, very warm, and think for a long time about snowfields and winds and Christopher Columbus.
Chapter 15.
For 2 days, John and Sylvia and Chris and I loaf and talk and ride up to an old mining town and back, and then it's time for John and Sylvia to turn back home. We ride into Bozeman from the canyon now, together for the last time. Up ahead, Sylvia's turned around for the third time, evidently to see if we're all right. She's been very quiet the last 2 days. A glance from her yesterday seemed apprehensive, almost frightened. She worries too much about Chris and me. At a bar in Bozeman, we have one last round of beer, and I discuss routes back with John. Then we say perfunctory things about how good it's all been, and how we'll see each other soon, and this is suddenly very sad to have to talk like this, like casual acquaintances. Out in the street again, Sylvia turns to me and Chris, pauses, and then says, "It'll be all right with you. There's nothing to worry about."
"Of course," I say.
Again, the same frightened glance. John has the motorcycle started and waits for her.
"I believe you," I say.
She turns, gets on, and with John, watches oncoming traffic for an opportunity to pull out. "I'll see you," I say. She looks at us again, expressionless this time. John finds his opportunity and enters into the traffic lane. Then Sylvia waves, as if in a movie. Chris and I wave back. Their motorcycle disappears in the heavy traffic of out-of-state cars, which I watch for a long time. I look at Chris, and he looks at me. He says nothing. We spend the morning sitting at first on a park bench marked Senior Citizens Only, then get food, and at a filling station, change the tire and replace the chain adjuster link. The link has to be remachined to fit, and so we wait and walk for a while, back away from the main street. We come to a church and sit down on the lawn in front of it. Chris lies back on the grass and covers his eyes with his jacket.
"You tired?" I ask him.
"No." Between here and the edge of the mountains to the north, heat waves shimmer the air. A transparent winged bug sets down from the heat on a stalk of grass by Chris's foot. I watch it flex its wings, feeling lazier every minute. I lie back to go to sleep, but don't. Instead, a restless feeling hits. I get up. "Let's walk for a while," I say.
"Where?"
"Toward the school."
"All right."
We walk under shady trees on very neat sidewalks, past neat houses. The avenues provide many small surprises of recognition. Heavy recall. He's walked through these streets many times. Lectures. He prepared his lectures in the peripatetic manner, using these streets as his academy. The subject he'd been brought here to teach was rhetoric, writing, the second of the 3 R's. He was to teach some advanced courses in technical writing,
and some sections of freshman English. "Do you remember this street?" I ask Chris. He looks around and says, "We used to ride in the car to look for you." He points across the street. "I remember that house with the funny roof. Whoever saw you first would get a nickel. And then we'd stop and let you in."